I'm testing the microphone. I don't know what this microphone did to seem so untrustworthy that I'm always testing this microphone. But Lord knows, maybe the microphone's been testing me all along. I just keep on testing the microphone. Hello and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I'm recording from my hotel room here in beautiful Houston, Texas, where I will be playing the Joke Joint Comedy Club all weekend. Come out and see me. If you want to get tickets, you go to jokejointcomedyshowcase.com, and you can see me tonight, tomorrow night, or Saturday night. All good options. Come and see me. Headline, the Joke Joint Comedy Club, Houston's oldest comedy club. I am excited. I am in a great mood. I'm working. That always makes me happy. I'm doing comedy. It's what I love doing the most in the world. So I'm happy. I'm a happy fella. By the way, I could be happier. There's always more happiness to be got. And that could happen if you made a donation on moderndayphilosophers.net. Just saying. If you make a $20 or more donation, I will send you some complimentary Tweaked Audio earbuds brought to you by the good people at tweakedaudio.com. Enter promo code MDP if you want to buy some on your own and get 1/3 off, plus free shipping and a lifetime warranty or guarantee. I'm not sure which one it is. Now, on to business here. On to business. Mark Schiff, phenomenal, funny comedian who came up through the comedy ranks. We talk about it with Jerry Seinfeld and is still friends with him, and we talk about how they go on the road together. And you guys know I'm also a big Seinfeld fan. I've mentioned it more than once on the show, so I was excited to hear about that. Mark also told me before the show that he had met Don Rickles and he knew Rodney Dangerfield. So if you're wondering in the interview, how does he know to bring up the time that he met it? He never said that on the interview. That's right, there was prior knowledge going into this. I knew that he'd met them and I got the stories on the show. Just saying, in case you were wondering. Also, Mark has been walking that tightrope of being an observant Jew and being a comedian, something that I try to do myself, keeping Shabbat, which is something I struggle with because, as you'll hear in the interview, it's tough to do as a comedian. But Mark has been doing it for quite a long time, and I was fascinated to hear about that. Now, Shabbat, if you don't know what it is, it's from Friday night sundown to Saturday night sundown every week, and the Jews who choose to observe Shabbat turn off all electricity, don't drive, don't use our phones, and we try to connect to that greater something, to try and connect to that universe, trying to connect to God, try to connect to family, try to connect to anything without using a Wi-Fi connection. So we talk about that in the interview. Boy, am I excited for you to hear this. And we talk about Hillel the Elder, who, I forgot to tell you in the interview, and I'll tell you right now, was born in Babylon, lived from 110 BCE and died in 10 CE in Jerusalem. He was a famous Jewish religious leader, one of the most important figures in Jewish history. He is associated with the development of the Mishnah and the Talmud. He is renowned within Judaism as a sage and a scholar. He was the founder of the House of Hillel. House of Hillel, it sounds like a good fraternity. School for Tanaim, the sages of the Mishnah, and the founder of a dynasty of sages who stood at the head of Jews living in the land of Israel until roughly the 5th century of the Common Era. And I think there's, on most college campuses, there's a Hillel, which is a program named after Hillel. Big rabbi, big sage. Today's episode is brought to you by the fantastic and phenomenal Stand Up Records, who have this to say. Take a listen.
Warning, stand-up records may cause intestinal distress, fits of insane laughter, instant diarrhea, existential malaise, headaches, nausea, dizziness, vomiting, seasonal affective disorder, more headaches, pneumomono ultramicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis. Stand-up records should not be handled by women who are pregnant, may become pregnant, have ever been pregnant, or personally know anyone who has been pregnant. Do not consult your doctor if he's operating heavy machinery. Stand-up records is for external application only. And stand-up records is, of course, good for a few laughs. So remember that standuprecords.com for the world's finest comedy CDs, DVDs, and merchandise. That's standuprecords.com. The revolution will be hilarious.
All right, well, there you have it. Stand Up Records, go pick up some comedy. Go get my album, Some Kind of Comedian, available on standuprecords.com. All right, without further ado, I am now going to give you, well, except for the intro song, my talk with Mark Schiff. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Ready when you are.
I'm ready there, young man. Young fella.
Okay, I'll be ready in a minute.
Okay. I'm ready when you're about ready.
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 Ready or not, here we go.
Here we go. Okay, I'm upstairs in the Lobel House production studio.
Yes.
With Mark Schiff. How are you? Thanks for being here.
Excellent. 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 Thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure. I didn't know if I was going to make it.
You didn't know?
No.
But do you ever know?
No. That's the thing is, but I'm here, so
yeah.
Now I know I've made it.
You've made it.
But I didn't know if I was going to make it.
How would you have known?
Yeah. I had no, even when I said to you, I'll be there, I had no idea if I was going to make it.
Right. That's the thing of it. You never really, you never know.
Yeah. Right now, there's somebody that thinks they're going to make it, but they're not going to make it.
Hopefully, you'll make it through the whole show.
Yeah.
We still don't know that.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Orthodox Judaism, they say things, what is it like, Meretz Hashem, I'll make it through this talk I'm giving.
Sure.
Because they know that at any given moment, they can have a big stroke and just drop dead. So, I've heard rabbis do this like every 14 seconds.
Which means God willing.
Yeah. God willing, I'll be able to deliver this next sentence to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they deliver it. God willing, I'll be able to deliver this next sentence to you.
Right.
So it's they're much more tentative about life than I would like to be.
Yeah. And then if they're not able to deliver the sentence, they go, God not willing.
Yeah, God not willing.
God not willing.
Yeah.
Can't deliver this sentence.
No, we didn't make it through.
So you grew up Orthodox, correct?
No, absolutely not true.
Oh, let me do that again for editing.
Yeah.
You didn't grow up Orthodox, did you?
I did not. I grew up... I grew up in a Reformed Jewish family.
Okay.
My parents were Reformed Jews. And what happened was my parents needed a place. There was no daycare when I was growing up. So, and my parents worked full time.
Where was this?
The old country, the Bronx.
Bronx, okay.
Yeah. Very Jewish neighborhood. Even the Puerto Ricans were Jewish.
Riverside?
No, the Bronx. Riverdale.
Riverdale is what I meant.
Is up above the Bronx.
Let me do that again for editing. Riverdale?
Riverdale. No, I grew up in a very poor area. Riverdale, people have money.
Mm-hmm.
We knew people with money. We had no money. In fact, we lived in a 6-floor walk-up, and when we first moved in, my parents could not afford to put a lock on the door of our apartment. But there was a dresser drawer in there. So when we go to sleep at night, my mother and father would push the dresser against the door.
That's one way of doing it.
That's one way.
At least that way, if somebody breaks in, you'll hear the dresser fall over.
Yeah,
that's right.
So anyway, my parents sent me to an Orthodox Jewish day school because they kept me till 6 o'clock. You know, they're like mini prisons, so they kept me till like 6-7 o'clock at night. And on Fridays, because of Shabbos, the Sabbath, the school would get out at 2. So the school bus would let me off. On my corner, there was a coffee shop. And I would sit in the coffee shop till my parents came home, till 7 o'clock. I would sit there for 5 hours waiting for my parents in the coffee shop.
Did you have coffee?
I did not. I was only like 8 years old, but they had meatloaf on Fridays.
Oh, in a coffee shop?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was Meatloaf Friday.
It was in those days, they used to do that kind of thing in coffee shops.
Yes, they did. It was fantastic. Well, coffee shops were like mini little restaurants.
They had, I know what you mean.
They had everything.
Like a diner.
It was like a, neighborhood,
So you had 5 hours to make a piece of meatloaf last until
your parents I sat there and I drank Coke and ate meatloaf and talked to the chef, Hank, who was about 75 years old.
And he became a buddy of yours?
He became a buddy. Certain times in my life, I was befriended by older men.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Were you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a guy named Ruby that was a friend of mine, and I've always liked, I've always had an affection for older guys, like as friends.
Why?
I have a friend now, Jimmy Sortino, is 98. He has more energy than the both of us put together.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's easy to beat me.
Yeah, well.
So
I got another friend, George Stanley, who's 88. I love old guys.
Why? What do you think it is about them?
The ones I tend to pick have some wisdom, and they're just nice guys. You know, when they hit the age of 88 or 90, they're kind of authentic to some degree.
Do you think when you're that age, you'll be friends with 100-year-olds? Or do you think at that
point...
Right,
that's a good question. It's a really good... Like, I'd have to find, like, a 114-year-old.
Right.
Might be rough. Might be rough.
You might run out of friends earlier than everybody else.
There you go. I'm depressed now, because I know what I'm heading into. No friends and alone.
Right. Well, I'm sorry.
Right. But fresh diaper.
Yeah.
That's all that matters.
As
long as you got that, you got everything.
Yeah. So,
comes to a certain point in your life, you don't have health, so you can't go, at least have my health, but have a fresh diaper.
Right.
Nice.
At least I have my diaper.
Sweet.
The thing. So let's go back to the diner with the meatloaf.
School would drop me off on Friday afternoon, 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. My parents come home 6 or 7. I would sit, and they would kind of babysit me, the coffee shop.
Until they would get home.
And then my parents get home.
And then would you guys do Shabbat when they would get there?
Never did Shabbat. We did a couple of holidays a year. Not really. But I always had a very strong feeling for religious Jews.
Did you feel left out from the other kids that they'd all presumably go home and do Shabbat and you'd go home and not do it?
You know, I did feel like I wanted to be part of that, but there was no way in because I'm, 8 years old and I'm living with my parents. So I had to wait till I got older.
There was a feeling of you were looking basically to fit in.
There's always been that feeling with me, feeling excluded from things. I was the guy in softball when they were choosing up sides. I was, what about him?
Yeah, me too. I'm same situation.
They would get everybody on both sides and go, what about him?
And I still feel like that in life.
That's right. What about him?
I still feel like they're all picking everybody, Comedy Central or whoever it is, and I'm still like standing there waiting
to
be
picked. About him?
Yeah.
I played a softball game about 2 years ago, and nobody had picked me as they were picking people. And all of a sudden, that old feeling from like a long time ago started coming on again. And I said, all right, guys, I had this growing up. I'm not going to put up with it now, And they chose me on a...
You forced them into it.
And this was, by the way, this was the first game that these people played, but somehow they knew to exclude me. They had no idea how good I was or how fast I was.
They just,
they could
feel it.
They could feel, let's leave this guy out as long as possible.
Yeah. You still carry that thing with you then.
Some things will never leave.
Right.
They can get a little easier, but people go, I'll go to therapy, I'll get better. Nothing leaves.
So you're an only child?
Only child.
Okay.
My parents, my mother used to say, and I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, she would say, when we had you, we didn't want any more. So I don't know if that was because I was so great or because I was so horrible. And then the other one was, when we had you, you broke the mold.
Mm-hmm. What's the mold?
My mother would throw out these sayings, but never explained what they meant. So you can pick or choose.
Are your parents still with you?
No. My father died in 88 and my mother an hour ago. So
that's why you didn't know if you'd make it.
That's why I didn't know I'd make it.
Yeah.
But they'll wait for me.
Yeah, that's good.
Where's she going? You know what I mean?
I have a podcast to do. Do me a favor. can you keep the body warm?
So my mother about 10 years ago and my father in 88.
So
was the deal.
So you're alone.
I'm an orphan and I'm looking for somebody that wants to adopt, an old Jewish man.
How many kids do you have?
3.
Okay, so you didn't want to do that to them. You basically said...
Jacob, Eli, and Noah. 3. If I knew I was having 3 boys, I would have named them Mo, Larry, and Curly. But you don't know.
You don't want to get just stuck with Mo, Larry. It doesn't make any sense.
No. No, you don't want to get Mo and Larry. Because then you have to name the girl Curly, and people just smack her around,
Or what if you, even worse, you don't get that third kid at all.
Yeah,
you
got more
and then,
than our,
and then people go, what happened? You ran out of steam?
Yeah, the other one died. So, so Mo and Larry, right. And you guys gave up after that, right?
Yeah.
There's no more sex after that.
Couldn't keep it going.
You know what's amazing that somebody said about giving birth to funny people? One woman gave birth to three of the Stooges. Larry was not a brother, but Mo, Larry, and Shemp were brothers. No, mm-hmm. Mo, Curly, and Shemp were brothers. So one woman gave birth to three of them. And then one woman gave birth to all the Marx brothers. It's pretty remarkable. One woman popped out some of the funniest people that ever lived, you know, groups of them.
How long do you think it took before the funny kicked in?
Right. Right, right.
Was
right.
it a funny pregnancy?
Funny pregnancy. They came out. Yeah. It, probably those guys probably had were genetically coded to be funny.
Funny delivery. The doc, funny. The doctor.
Mother, doctor smacked the mother, as Rodney would say.
Right.
So that was one of the great Rodney jokes. What was one of the Rodney? He says, "When I was born, the doctor showed me my father. Then he turned me over and said, 'Look, twins.'" So.
How did you get to meet Rodney?
Rodney was a man that changed my life, Rodney Dangerfield.
Right.
So they don't think we're talking about Rodney King.
Right. Do you think that was a risk we were running?
I have. They go, wow, this guy's a huge fan of Rodney King. He said Rodney saved his life. It's hard to believe.
Sure.
So, 12 years old, my parents take me to a place called the Boulevard Nightclub in Queens, in Rego Park, New York. 12. There's a singer who's starring there named Al Martino. He played in The Godfather. He played the Frank Sinatra role in The Godfather.
Okay.
Rodney Dangerfield was opening the show. I'm sitting there, 12 years old. I see this guy break through the curtains, start delivering these one-line jokes, people laughing, screaming, and all of a sudden, the light bulb went on. I had a moment epiphany. Of clarity, an epiphany, and I said, that's it. I know what I want to do for a living. And I never looked back. I was 12. It was like, you know, it was an amazing moment. And I have a photo from that evening with my parents sitting at the table in the nightclub. The
three of us
sitting there. It's really amazing.
You still have it.
Yeah. Then when I got older and I started doing the clubs and becoming a comedian, I got a chance to meet Rodney. And my first money I ever made writing, I sold a joke to Rodney. And
how much did you get for it?
$50. It was, the joke was, I'll tell you, you know you're getting old. I went to the cemetery to visit my father and two guys chased me with shovels.
It's so,
yeah, it was a good joke.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to meet Rodney and I told him all about when I saw him when he was a kid. It meant nothing absolutely to him.
Mm-hmm.
But we became friends and started hanging out together.
I had, when I was about, I'd say also about 12 years old, we met Jackie Mason for the first time.
Right.
At Tavern on the Green.
Sure.
And I have, my mom took a photo with me and him. And many years later, when I wound up meeting him and becoming friends with him, I dug up that photo. I said, hey, wow. Take a look. It meant even less to him, believe
me. Right. Then, nothing means anything to most of these guys.
It meant nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
What are you showing me this for? What the hell do I
know.
Care
you
about
can
this?
Say to these guys, you know, I was going into open heart surgery and I was holding a picture of you and it really pulled me through and they go, what do I care? Yeah. The important thing about with comedians is you got to be careful not to become bitter when you get older. That's, I see some of them turn a little bit and it becomes a problem. So I fight the, I never want that to happen.
Right. And well, what do you think are the most effective strategies to keep it from happening?
Being involved, helping other people. You know, like if somebody asks you something, actually pay attention. Don't just write it off because you can't get anything from them.
Mm-hmm.
That helps ward off some bitterness.
That's the biggest one?
It's a big one. It's meaningless to you, I know, but...
No, it's not meaningless to me.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's a big one. Because I've seen it. I've seen it with some comedians. They don't get what they want. They don't become big stars, and they get angry. And
what about the ones that do? Do they get bitter too, or not?
Some of them. What happens is because we're angry people. A lot of comedians. We're upset.
Mm-hmm.
So being upset can wear you down. if you don't have an outlet for it.
So it's about maintaining some kind of positivity, bringing good into the world?
Well, it's about working and being able to get those things out that bother you. Yeah, that's a big part of it. Being positive, you know, you do good things, you have a fairly positive outlook, unless you're, you know, chemically unbalanced.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you met Rodney Dangerfield when you're 12, or you saw him when you were 12.
Saw him when I was 12.
And then you met him years later, sold him a joke, and that was when you were already working as a stand-up comic.
I was working, I still wasn't making any money, but I was working at the clubs.
Mm-hmm. This was also around the time of the big comedy boom of the 80s, right?
Yes. This was 79, 80, 81.
So can you describe the scene back then?
You know, we owned the city, we felt like. I mean, it was just a, you know, couple of comedians, I don't know how many, 50 of us.
That's it.
Probably.
Wow.
Just going from one club to another to another. I mean, every night was the same 10 guys, 20 guys, you know.
And those guys, can you name them?
Okay, so it was Seinfeld, Paul Reiser, Larry Miller, Gilbert Gottfried, The Untouchables, Weeden, Finkel, and Fay, George Wallace, me, Richard Belzer, Barry Diamond, Bob Shaw, Ed Bluestone, Andy Kaufman, I said Richard Lewis, Larry David. Pretty good.
Yeah, it's a good group.
Pretty good. Elaine Boozler.
And you were all friends?
No, we weren't all friends. A few of us were, you know, people had their little cliques that they hung out with. But we knew each other and we were very polite and nobody ever got into fights with each other.
Right. So who were your clique?
My clique was Jimmy Brogan, Gilbert Gottfried, Seinfeld, Larry Miller, Paul Reiser, a guy named Michael Hampton Kane, and Steve Middleman.
Oh, wow. It's a good click.
Yeah.
It's a good click.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I've always had stage fright. Terrible, terrible insecurity up on stage.
Still?
Yeah. It's better. But like I said, you never get over things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know who, you know, every once in a while, you know, does an ex-smoker get over smoking? He just doesn't smoke. And, you know, if you have that type of personality, you got it. You might go 100 years without doing it, but it doesn't mean that.
He's still a smoker.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. I went and I did a show at the Improv one night, 76 maybe, no, earlier, 75. Anyway, what happened was I had such stage fright and I bombed so badly, I didn't get up on stage for like 3-4 years. I quit after one show and I went to acting school. I started taking acting lessons, dance lessons, singing lessons.
Now, any of those acting school kids, did they go on to be big actors too?
Don't remember any of them. Don't remember any of them. Okay. I took acting lessons for 20 years.
Wow.
Didn't help a bit. All they try to do is turn you into who you are. I mean, the best actors are, you know.
Right, they just go out there and.
I could never get to who I am. So I get Jackie Mason, I don't know who I am. I don't know who I'm going to be. They try to get me to be who I am. I can't be that guy, so I have to be somebody else so I don't get the job.
Exactly.
You know, so yeah, yeah. I don't know. So I took acting, I took dance lessons, I did a lot of stuff.
So you're saying at the acting school, it was very hard for you to be yourself?
Yeah, it was hard for me to listen to other actors. Comedians, it's hard for us to listen sometimes. We can listen to the laughs.
Mm-hmm.
But in most comedians, I think, have a... It's tough. We want to be in control. That's why we're like the only ones up on stage doing everything. We're director, producer, writer, actor.
Right. Why do you think it's tough?
It might be an inherently some sort of fear and a selfishness, you know, and not and an insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in control of everything, you may not be able to be found out.
What are you worried about being found out about?
That you're not up to snuff like everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
I think everyone in comedy is worried that they're a fraud.
Probably to some degree. Because it's such a tentative thing. On any given night, we never have the same audience. I mean, you know, on Broadway, they get pretty much the same audience in every night to see this, you know, show. One night I'm in Pasadena, one night I'm here. It's a different thing. The lights are in a different direction. So it's always very tentative what's going to happen.
You know what I think it is? I think it's no certification. I think if doctors never got any, you know, let's say medical school was just something you decide to do.
Right.
And at the end of it, you decide when it's time to start being a doctor.
Right.
I think every doctor would have the same thing that every comedian has, where they would feel, I'm not sure if I'm really a doctor.
Right.
These guys are doctors. I don't know if I'm really, there's no, you know, it's a nonsense thing. It's just a piece of paper that somebody prints out and says, okay, you're an expert now. But
yes.
There's no piece of paper for comedians.
No.
And I think that's what it is. We're waiting for someone to give us a paper that says you're an expert, you know?
Never going
to
happen.
And it never happens.
Never. The paper is every night at the end. They give you a check.
Right.
That's all you got. And you're as good as your last show.
So from the time that you were working in the clubs and you were working in Catch a Rising Star in the comic strip until now, at some point you became more religious as a Jew.
I like the way you say Jew.
As a Jew?
Some people say it differently. They say Jew.
As a Jew.
You know what I mean?
That's, yeah. I have a nice flow to it.
You do,
yeah.
And you didn't have any angst or anything bothering you about this.
Yeah.
As a Jew.
I'm very happy to be a Jew. I think it worked out well enough, you know?
As opposed to the old Robert Klein routine, he was flying some airline to Germany, and he goes, would the Jew order the kosher meal, please stand up, the Jew?
That's so funny. Is that a Robert Klein bit?
Yeah.
That happened to me on a plane.
Yeah.
That happened to me on a KLM plane going to Holland.
Yeah.
And I never knew that was a Robert Klein bit, but it was a story that I told people because I thought it was hysterical. That's very funny. I never knew that. I remember I had ordered a kosher meal, and the flight attendant went on the loudspeaker. Is there a Jew shitting? She kept saying shitting. Is there a Jew shitting somewhere in this section who ordered the kosher meal? So it really happens.
Right.
Where is the Jew?
Where's the Jew?
Where is the Jew shitting?
Yeah.
The Jew shitting right over here. The more you say the Jew, the more he's shitting.
You ever notice the way they wrap these kosher meals? It's like there's plutonium in it. It takes you like an hour to unwrap. There's like seven layers of plastic, then aluminum foil, then a seal, and then little seals.
We don't even
seals.
Want non-kosher air getting into that.
No.
Yeah.
And then you open it up and you go, I'm not eating this.
Right.
Bring me the pork chop, will you? This is not good.
So where did the transition happen that you wound up becoming a religious?
Happened in 85. I took a Torah class, and I liked my rabbi, and I started going.
At the time, you're touring and...
Touring, yeah, all that stuff.
So what inspired you to take a Torah class?
Like I said, I was always interested in our people. I always had a respect for the religious ones.
Mm-hmm.
I always enjoyed reading philosophy and, deep thoughts. There was a book called The Path of the Just by a guy named Chaim Lizzuto, filled with Jewish philosophy. Heschel, I love. Mm-hmm. So I would read this stuff. I wanted to take a class. I don't know what made me do it. I just saw there was like some sign up. It says Torah class tonight. And I went.
I feel like in your story, there's a lot of trying to find yourself.
A place where, like Cheers, a place where you can go home, where people know you. So, yes, I crave that. I don't mind being by myself, but I like community and groups.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of comedians are the opposite, but I do.
Yeah, I agree. I'm with you. Yeah. I like it too.
That's why marriage works for me. I don't want to live by myself. Even though, I don't like my wife at all. I just, I'd rather not live by myself. And she doesn't like me, so we agree on something.
Good, yeah. You have some kind of mutual... Yeah. Dislike for each other. That works.
So, yeah. I was lucky. I found a great woman. I married up. So, anyway, continue on.
So, you're in this class. You're trying to find yourself, essentially. And do you think what resonated was this warm childhood feeling? Or
I felt very at home with the rabbi and his wife. I immediately liked them. I trusted them. And they made me feel very comfortable.
So it was like a sense of family.
Yeah. And then what happened was they invited me for Shabbos, which they always do. The Orthodox, when they get a flounder on the hook,
right?
You know, they try to bring you on the ship,
right?
You know, and suck the air out of you. No. So he said, "Why don't you come to my house for Shabbos?" And I went, and I had about 50 Shabboses with him and his wife. I would just, he'd say, "Just drop by," and I would do this thing that most people would not do. I would just stop by.
Mm-hmm.
If so, you know, Shabbos, I'd knock on the door. "Hey, what are you guys doing?" "Oh, come on in. Yeah, you got a place to eat?" "No." And I would sit with them.
Right, right.
His name was Rabbi Braverman.
Okay.
From Eshet Torah. Great man.
And so at what point did you decide I want to make a lifestyle out of this?
Little by little. Mm-hmm. You know, little by little. I moved into the neighborhood. I lived on Rabbi Row. There were like four different rabbis on my block. So little by little, I kept going to classes and going back to synagogue.
And how did this affect your other world of comedy?
It's an interesting question. You can't really be a stand-up comedian and really be truly 100% Orthodox Jew in the sense of keeping all the holidays, the Sabbaths. It's impossible. Friday night and Saturday are big. So you can maybe, during one part of the year, because Shabbos ends at 8:30, you know, or 4:30 or 5 o'clock, you can pull it off. But for a lot of the year, it's almost an impossible thing to do. But where it impacted me was, I always work clean anyway, but it gave me more of a reason to work clean. And I was very careful about what I said and still able to maintain it and keep it very funny. Within, most comedians don't work in a guideline of any restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
I had some. And I was still able to do it.
So you enjoyed the challenge?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you walk the line between reverence and irreverence? Because comedy is so irreverent.
Right.
You take on a certain amount of reverence.
Right.
It's a... You know, it's funny because I used to like really want to be like a counterculture guy. Like my heroes were George Carlin and
sure.
Lenny Bruce, these guys. And I thought... Well, you become an observant Jew, you start keeping Shabbat, it doesn't make you very counterculture. But then I thought about it, well, it's pretty much the most counterculture thing you could do because the culture is completely against it.
Right, that's right. Right.
So if you're truly counterculture...
you're further in than PETA.
Yeah.
You know, actually, the Orthodox Jews are environmentally like the greenest group of all. Right?
I don't know.
One day a week or 2 days a week, they don't drive. They don't use electricity. They don't waste gas. I mean, if this country would one day a week stop driving, they would save billions of gallons of gas and ozone emissions and all that. So mm-hmm. The Jews are really way ahead like that.
Has being religious cost you opportunities in comedy?
Yeah, I mean, because there are certain holidays I would not work and stuff like that.
But more or less not, it hasn't really been...
It's affected, but not 100%, no. No. I had an agent once. I booked a show, and I realized that it was like on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. Because I put it down the calendar, and then I didn't see the holiday. So I called him once. I realized, I said, "Listen, I can't do this date." He goes, "Why not?" I go, "It's a Jewish holiday." So he said, "Well, what do you want me to tell them?" So I said, "Well, tell them the truth." He goes, "I'll think of something."
Yeah, you can't just say that. Just say.
But it hasn't really completely impacted me. But it has in a sense because I know in my heart that I can't give it 100%.
The comedy or the Judaism?
Unless you go from one side to the other, you're splitting it up a little.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless you just go, "I'm giving up all Friday nights forever and just do..." So if I don't do that, then I'm not going to give it 100% because there's a little part of me that doesn't want to do it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So how do you fight that?
It's a tough one. It's the Achilles heel. It's a tough one. You know? I'm banking that my creator marks with a curve, so.
Well, I think this is a good transition to get into the philosophy because Alex picked somebody.
The Rambam.
Hopefully, well, no, but close.
Maimonides.
Hopefully somebody you're familiar with is Rabbi Hillel.
Hillel and Shammai.
Yeah.
Shammai the whale or Shammai the...
Shammai the rabbi.
That's Shamu.
Close.
Right.
Yeah. But he might have had to change his name in the whale protection, whale protection program at this point after all the deaths.
Hillel and Shamu. No, yeah. Shammai more.
Shammai. Yeah. Shammai. That sounds Japanese, doesn't it?
Yeah. Akira Kurosawa, his new movie, Shammai.
Shammai.
Shammai Hokamayang.
Alex says, what you have in common, Mark is a devout Jew. Hillel is looked at as a good example of Jewish wisdom.
He is.
Both wise Jews.
Wise Jews.
Wise Jews. So he said, Hillel emphasized duty to yourself and to your fellow man as the basis for Judaism, which is what you were talking about as a way to not become bitter.
That's right. I knew I liked Hillel.
Yeah. That was the exact advice, pretty much, that you said. Do something for somebody else.
Right.
He preached the golden rule, which boils down to treat people the way you want to be treated.
Right.
This even applies to daily habits like cleaning. As Hillel said, the soul is a guest on earth and the body is its house. So I've got a very roomy home for my soul right now.
That's right.
Which is, you know.
That's right. You have a mansion.
I'm really treating my soul great. As I lose weight, I feel bad the soul might, you know, leave for a better place.
No, it's not. It's going to stick with you. You got the right one.
Okay, that's good. So it's letting the soul down if you don't take care of your body. Well, that could be a counter-argument.
That's heavy, yeah.
Finally, he said we must be good people in the here and now because procrastinating, it is indicative of selfishness. Which we talked about, you need a little bit of selfishness to be a comedian. There's another...
How about the Hillel you left out, or do you have it there, standing on one foot?
I don't know if we got to the one foot, but I remember. Oh, there it is. A rude Gentile asked Hillel to summarize the Torah while standing on one foot. He said, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow."
Right.
This is the whole Torah. The rest is explanation. Now go and learn.
Rest is commentary.
Right. Right.
Who knew this Gentile was rude that they had to put that in there?
I don't know.
Who was standing there with Hillel and said, that was a rude Gentile, Hillel?
Well, it's got to be kind of rude to say, explain the whole thing on one foot. That's rude to make anyone do anything on one foot. In your whole life, have you ever asked anyone to do anything on one foot? Excluding, you know, maybe sexual acts. Other than that.
No, I have not. I've never asked anybody to do anything on one foot and one arm.
It's got to be rude. Asking anyone to... It's uncomfortable to be on one foot.
Yeah, but we didn't know what Hillel liked.
He might have liked being on one foot.
I mean, he used to maybe he used to hop around the village.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he was a pirate. Maybe he had a peg leg.
Yeah.
Explain on one foot. He had no other foot. He had no options.
Here comes one foot Hillel. Right?
He wasn't being rude at all. He was just giving him the only option he had.
Yeah.
What else do you know about Hillel?
Not a lot. I know that he was a good man, that he was not easy to anger.
Right. I remember learning about that.
Yeah. He was, you could ask Hillel anything. That's why they asked the one foot thing, because Hillel was known where you can ask him anything. I mean, you could have said to Hillel, you know, explain the hotel we're standing on your head. And Hillel would just laugh it off.
Right.
He was that type of guy. He was a loose guy.
And very acrobatic.
Very acrobatic for an Orthodox rabbi who just eats sponge cake day in and day out. He was really in tremendous condition. But he was free of a lot of... he liked questions, Hillel.
Right. And you know what? He was also the first Jew, I believe, to have a sandwich named after him.
The Hillel sandwich.
The Hillel sandwich in part of Passover. Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
I think that's where it started from, all these delis naming sandwiches.
Sandwiches after Jews.
Right. He might have started that.
Yeah, you walk into a restaurant, let me get the Hillel. Really?
Nobody orders the Hillel.
Nobody orders the Hillel. So you want the matzo with the bitter herbs? Yeah, let me get that. The Hillel diet.
It was hard to get him angry.
Yeah, he was the Dr. Oz of his day, the Hillel diet.
What do you think maybe they named the worst tasting sandwich after him I'll get him angry.
Yeah, that's right. They did it just to anger him. Right.
I know how to get under Hillel's skin. Watch this. We named this shitty sandwich after you. It's not even on bread.
That's right.
It's on matzah.
But you cannot get Hillel upset no matter what.
People used to poke him in the eye, ring the doorbell, he'd open the door, he'd poke him in the eye, and they'd run away.
They'd look at his wife and go, is that your wife? And he would just shake it off. Nothing seemed to bother Hillel. Yeah. Is that your wife? That's good old Don Rickles.
Yeah. So how did you meet Don Rickles?
I went backstage after a show one night in Vegas. We said we were comedians, and they said, come on back. Where are you guys working? I said, I'm doing this club and that club, little club. And I said, you know, one day I'd really like to headline in Vegas like you.
Mm-hmm.
And he just went berserk. You headline? You know how it took me 30 years working, you know, lounges at 5 in the morning, people trying to strangle me. And, you know, it upset him to no end to think that here comes these little creepy kids. The truth is, he was no Hillel.
No Hillel.
He was no Hillel. Hillel said, you know, one day I want to be a great rabbi like you. Fine.
Yeah.
That's nice. Don Rickles, I want to be a great comedian like you. Who are you to think that you could?
Yeah. You dummy. Get out of here.
Get out of here, you moron.
So that didn't go so smooth.
No, Hillel would never call you moron.
Right. What's it like when you tour with Jerry Seinfeld? What are some of the things that you'd never, that only happen when you tour with Jerry Seinfeld?
Private jet and Ritz-Carlton.
Okay.
That's a Diana.
That's, yeah, I guess so. Yeah. You can't beat that.
Yeah.
Right.
That's enough.
Yeah.
So, well, first of all, you're touring with one of the great comedians, who's just a master at what he does, also works clean, and his stuff is, so I get to see and watch him work, and I get to work with him and go over stuff with him. He helps me with routines, I help him with routines. Private jet, you know, a little red carpet rolled out, a little, you know, whatever you want to eat on there, you know, they got sandwiches and fruit and nothing like drinking soy milk at 50,000 feet.
Right.
There's just something beautiful about it.
Yeah.
And then we check into the best hotels in the country. And it's one of those gigs that, you know, I'll go away with them for 2, 3, 4 days. And I will have spent $5 when I got home. Because everything is completely taken care of. And when I land, you know, like, let's say I got to meet him in the Midwest somewhere. So I'll fly myself on a regular, you know, American Airlines, whatever. And there's a limousine waiting for you to take you to the hotel and...
Wow, fantastic.
Whatever you want. So it's cool.
What do you do on downtime? When you're, do you hang out?
Yeah, we hang out. We go to a movie, and he will rent out the movie theater.
The entire theater? Or the...
Just be three of us.
Well, is it just the theater that the movie's playing in, or is it the whole movie?
No, just, you know, let's say you go to a complex, there's 14 theaters.
Right, so he'll rent out.
So let's say we want to go see Transformers.
So he'll rent out just the Transformers theater or all 14?
No, just Transformers theater. So they'll call up and they'll go, listen, Mr. Seinfeld would like to buy, or get the theater for private showing. And we'll go in the morning early, like 10 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
maybe even before there's a showing, actually. And he'll rent it out and there'll just be the three of us.
Wow.
Me, Jerry, and the producer of the show. That's fun. And they come in and they open the stand for you. It's like almost like being like Howard Hughes. And, you know, you walk in, the candy people are there, and the popcorn people are there. And,
wow.
You know, it's really kind of cool.
Well, what else? You go see movies, what else?
And it's all just top flight, whatever. But the most important thing is it's friends hanging out.
Yeah.
It's a private time, even though we're working, that is so relaxing and so much fun. And Jerry and I always end up taking a walk together, weather permitting, which it usually is. We'll take like a 45-minute walk during the day and just chat, catch up.
That's nice.
Yeah.
And this has been a friendship since the early days.
We've been friends for 33 years or something like that.
Wow, that's fantastic.
We had a group, which I started to tell you about, the Funniest Men in America.
Uh-huh.
If you've heard of it. It was Larry Miller, Seinfeld, me, Paul Reiser, and a guy named Michael Hampton Kane. New Year's Eve, we're hanging out at the comic strip. None of us are really getting on. We're not big performers or big acts. And we decided, let's meet tomorrow for lunch. And we met for lunch. And we had such a great time. We said, every New Year's Day for the rest of our lives, let's have lunch together. And we did it for 30 years.
Wow.
Every New Year's Day, we'd meet in New York, except one year, Reiser was working on a movie called Aliens. He was in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to be there for New Year's, and he couldn't get off. So we all flew to England. We got a hotel.
Uh-huh.
And Reiser was off like New Year's Day and the next day. So we decided to have lunch. We were going to rent a Rolls Royce for the day,
mm-hmm.
but it was like $2,000. So we figured we could fly to France for less money and have lunch there. So we all got in a plane, and we flew to France, had lunch across from Notre Dame, and then flew back to England and went home. So we did it for 30 years. We haven't done it in the last couple of years.
That's a movie.
Yeah,
that's
really
sensational. That's got to be a movie.
And that was a great day. We would spend 10 or 12 hours together every New Year's Day and just go over the year and what we were doing. And, it was always, always tremendous fun.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Wow, that's a great
yeah.
thing that you've got, that you did that for so long. It's a shame
years.
That it stopped. You ought to bring it back.
We all got married, and eventually we all had kids, and eventually the wives, wanted to us to be home, and
switch it to a different day.
Yeah, there was something very special about New Year's Eve. It was really amazing.
That's great. You turned it into something fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Hillel.
So, all right. Mark, you ready to do the quotes?
I'm ready to the quotes.
Okay.
So, he who refuses to learn deserves extinction.
That's a harsh one.
Yeah, that's a heavy penalty. So if you don't want to learn, so like my mother used to say to me, "Oh, you're not willing to learn anything, are you? We're going to make you extinct." I mean, that was heavy.
Extinction. That is like, he never lost his cool, but he certainly,
yeah,
he certainly had a harsh way of saying things.
Well, I don't know that Hillel meant actual physical extinction. I think he meant that it's extinction of your soul, who you are.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he meant. If you're not willing to grow, you're going to go. You've heard that expression.
Yeah.
If you don't grow, you go. If you're not willing to learn and grow, you're pretty much dead and you're extinct. You don't really exist.
Right.
You're just part of the, like that TV show, The Walking Dead.
But he's saying deserves extinction. He's not saying will become extinct.
Right. Well, you do. You do, because you're wasting your life and your brain and,
I guess that's all there is to living is learning, right? Essentially.
It's a big part of it. A big part of it.
You go to an old age home, they're generally not learning there. They're just waiting to die.
It's a problem. People, one of the reasons I don't get bored that easily, because I'm always reading something or trying to learn something or going to a class or listening to a lecture.
Were there any moments where you learned something and it completely changed the way you look at the world?
Abraham Joshua Heschel. I've read his books. He changed my life.
What about them was so eye-opening for you?
His explanation of God, and his belief and his awe of this power changed my life.
Can you expand on that? What did he say?
Well, okay, so one thing he said that changed my life was that, a lot of people, and by the way, I have nothing, I'm going to talk for myself here. There are religions and people who believe in, they pray to a rock, or they pray to the sky, or they pray to the ocean, or nature. So Heschel said, I can never believe in something that I don't feel understands my emotions and who I am. So if I pray, I can't pray to a rock because I know a rock doesn't understand my tears, what I'm about.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it clear that what my concept of God needs to be like needs to be something that really understands where I'm coming from and my emptiness, my loneliness, my happiness, whatever it is. That worked for me. That changed my life.
So is your concept of God a reflection of yourself in some way? Is that what you're saying? It's
yeah. In a sense of we want to kind of be understood, to say, a comedian, what do? We go up on stage and please understand what I'm saying to you. and they pay you back, they say, I understand by laughing.
Right.
If they don't get it, you feel really misunderstood, and that's when there's a problem with some comedians. They keep things in their act that the audience doesn't get because they think they're right. And they'll buck the audience on it. You can never do that. If they don't like it, it's out. So
it is developing an understanding, a mutual understanding.
Yeah, between the two of you. There has to be an aha factor. They have to sit there and go, huh, I understand that. I get that.
And in order to want to do that, you had to have been somewhat misunderstood by probably by your parents. I think most comedians can attest to that.
Right. That's what we're sharing with them, a lot of it.
We're saying, these guys, they didn't understand me. Maybe if thousands of you understand me, it can equal something towards what I would have got out of one of them understanding me.
Right at home.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, my mother would say things like, I don't understand why you do that. I don't understand why you act that way. I don't understand how anyone can do something like that. And then I would try to explain. And then she'd go, no, you don't understand. Let me make this clear. And she tried to explain to me what I don't understand.
And meanwhile, she was telling you things you were telling me earlier that you didn't understand.
Right?
She was making, throwing comments at you, throwing
my whole family growing up could have been one conversation. I don't understand what you're talking about. And my mother would go, well, I don't understand your father. He doesn't understand you. I don't understand me. That was everything, because we disagreed on almost everything.
So you've gone out in a life in search of understanding. Hopefully.
Yeah. My mother would serve dinner, and I go, I don't like that. I don't understand why you don't like peas and carrots. I don't understand. She was always so bemiffed by the little things.
So funny.
Why aren't you using butter? I don't understand why you don't use butter anymore. You used to use butter. I don't understand. She was always...
she had no understanding.
Yeah, of anything. And my father would go, I don't know why your mother... I don't understand why your mother acts like this. I don't know why.
All right. Let's go to the next quote.
Okay. A quote about him. As Hillel the Elder, there's another snide remark they laid on him, the Elder, you know. And here comes old Hillel. So they're trying to clean that up a little with the Elder, to make it sound more respectful.
Sounds Mormon.
Yeah. The Elders.
The Elders.
Yeah.
So as Hillel the Elder had stated, whoever destroys a soul, it is considered as if he destroyed an entire world. And whoever that saves a life, it is considered as if he saved an entire world. Right. I've heard that saying before.
So every person is a world, in other words?
Yeah. Every person, my understanding is that the world was created just for you. Now, that could make you selfish, in a sense, if you really take it literally. But the rabbis taught that the world was created just for you, that it was created to give you pleasure and you to take advantage of everything in it. And if you don't, then you're ruining your life. You're throwing back a great gift that was given to you.
What if, by observing Jewish law or observing any religious law, you find less enjoyment in life?
Well, you have to look at what do you consider enjoyment. I mean, it just have to, you know, enjoyments are most, you realize, I think, as you get older, most things are overrated. So what I think is enjoyable at a younger age may not be so enjoyable older on. Like, I used to think desserts were, like, the greatest thing in the world. I don't believe that anymore. I just don't see they're necessary or... So I used to enjoy it, and I used to believe that my life would have not been as valuable without those things. But I was wrong.
Well, I'm going to make a counter-argument. You were wrong based on who you are now and what you value now. You may have been right based on who you were then and what you valued then.
I'll tell you why, to some degree, I disagree. Okay, so you got certain laws. We'll talk Judaism since you got Hillel. So you got certain things that you can't do as an Orthodox Jew. okay, you can't eat non-kosher foods, you can't go to certain shows, you can't do that. So you, it's a very Nancy Reagan thing. Just say no. So these Orthodox Jewish kids, a lot of them, not all of them, of course, but many of them grow up learning how to say no to things. So when in life bad stuff comes along, it's not as difficult for them to say no as other people because they've learned to control themselves. So one of my kids, let's say they grew up kosher and they grew up a lot of things, if someone offers them drugs, maybe because of all those no's, they might be a little less persuaded.
You're saying it's they have a stronger sense of self-control, self-discipline.
Yeah. So these things that you think are going to enhance your life may not. There's a certain point where you realize I may not know everything. Other people may know more than me. Young people don't have that.
So that's just something that comes with age and wisdom.
Not for everybody. You have to generally be on some growing path in order for that to happen.
So that goes back to the first quote. And if you're not learning, you're dead.
Yeah, to some degree. To some degree, I believe it. And of course, if you believe that, if you destroy a life, you've destroyed a world. It's true. It's true.
Maybe because every person affects so many people who then in turn affect so many people in the world.
That's right.
That might be another way of looking at it.
That's right.
So just the ripple effects of one existence can change the entire world.
That's right. That's right. As Chabad people say, one mitzvah at a time, change the world.
I think we have a third quote there, right?
Yeah. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am not for others, who am I? And if not now, when?
This one was hanging up in Mark Maron's garage, and he asked me what it means. And I didn't have a good answer for him. So I thought about it a bit back then, but then I forgot what I thought about. Can you read it again?
If I am not for myself, who will be for me?
Okay, so who's looking out for me if not me?
Right. Ultimately, you have to take care of yourself.
Okay.
People want to help you, but basically, in every area that I changed my life, it's because I wanted to and I was willing to work on it in every area. It was outside stimulation that may have provoked it.
Mm-hmm.
Going to a doctor saying, well, your blood pressure is too high, you got to do something about it. Okay, so he gives me that piece of information, which I call a moment of clarity. Sometimes you get this little pearl of wisdom and you either do something or you don't. Sometimes the world gives you the problem and shows it to you. And then you have to be willing to take it from there. You know, somebody once said, if I let you treat me as badly as I treat myself, then I would have to kill myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to get out of your own way. And you have to veto your own thinking. Because generally when you've got problems, the first thought that comes is a bad one. It's usually not the solution. It's usually the thing to make it worse.
Give me an example.
Okay, so take an alcoholic. The solution is to stop drinking.
Right.
What comes to his head is have another drink, it'll relax you.
Right, so you're saying usually people want to escalate the problem before they want to fix it.
They don't know they're doing it. Nobody does anything that they don't think is actually going to make the situation better. People that run into 7-Elevens with a gun to rob the place actually think they're going to make their life better by doing this. Nobody goes, let's go in there and destroy our lives. They go in, let's get some money, we're going to get some drugs, and we'll be happier this afternoon.
Right, so they're thinking they're enhancing their lives, but
totally,
really
no matter what it is. A guy that chokes somebody to death, they think, my life would be so much better if this person is out of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So
it takes this moment of clarity, in other words, to be able to make the distinction between what's good for you and what isn't.
Right.
Okay.
And it's generally doing the opposite of what you think. Okay, so if I am not for others, who am I?
So you got to be there for yourself. But if you're not there for other people, then what kind of a person are you? It's like you said earlier in the podcast, you'll become bitter.
Right. If I'm not out there trying to help people or do something good, then what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
What am I just taking up space for myself? You see it with single people, and there's nothing wrong with being single, but people that stay single and don't get married and have a family, eventually, when they turn like 50, most of them go nuts. They're just selfish, tight about everything. They're, you know, they can't be changed anymore. Having other people in your life helps to change you because you have to mold yourself to be able to, you know, exist with other people. Like if I was exactly the person I was when I met my wife, before I met my wife, marriage never would have lasted 25 years. I had to change.
Do you think it's worth all the headache and all the... Certainly, I know you joke about it a lot in your act about marriage.
Yeah.
But for people like me who aren't married yet and thinking about it, it can be very terrifying. It can be daunting to be like, oh my God, I'm going to be harassed for 25 years or more. And
it's funny. Seinfeld thought the same thing. That's what he said. He didn't get married for a long time because he would listen to all these comedians, you know, just bitching about their wives.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, what do I want this for?
Right.
I mean, he goes, there's got to be some truth in this.
Right, right. That's how I feel.
Yeah, well, there is truth in it.
And yet you're saying it's completely worth it.
It's the greatest relationship you'll ever have. Having kids is a great, incredible, but not nearly as difficult as a marriage. And that's where the work is. And that's where it goes back to growing. If you're not growing, you're going. The only way marriage works is if you're kind of growing. That doesn't mean you can't stay together for 50 years, but it's not really a marriage. It's like roommates.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want that. So, there is, marriage forces you to grow. No way around it. So that's kind of what that is. If I'm not for others, who am I? I do a thing every morning with my wife. First thing I do in the morning, I make her breakfast. I get up before her, and I make her a breakfast. I make coffee for her. So the first thing I've done on waking is doing something for somebody else. That, to some degree, sets the tone for the day and helps the marriage.
Does she do the first thing of the day something for you?
No, never.
All right.
Yeah.
No. Okay.
She gets ready for work. Well, what she does for me is, she gets up, gets ready for work. She has a great job. So, yeah, she is doing something for the family and for me. Absolutely. She's helping, you know, support and...
Okay, so it's a different way.
Yeah, it's a different way. But I need to specifically do something for the individual to kind of set the tone for the day.
And have there been times in your marriage where it's been so difficult you thought, I got to get out of here? And what kept you, I'm assuming it has happened.
Well, every marriage, you know, somebody once said about marriage, the only reason we didn't get divorced is because both of us didn't ever want to be divorced at the same time. Right, I wanted on Tuesday, she wanted on Thursday, you know, so.
Right.
What you have to be careful, in marriage what happens is sometimes one person goes crazy and the other sane, so they keep it together. Then that person goes crazy and the other one is sane, and then they keep it together. Mm-hmm. It's when you all go crazy at the same time that you got problems.
So as long as you can ride out there crazy without losing it.
Yeah, and never leave. Once you leave, it's hard to get back in the door. So you stay put. Love can disappear. And it's these people that go, oh, I need a 2-month break. Go ahead, see what happens. For the most part, it's hard to really hard to get back in. So just don't leave.
So the last part of the quote was, if not now, then when, right?
If not now, then when? It's kind of obvious, I mean, to some degree.
Yeah, if not
like
now.
Like we said earlier, we started talking about it, I didn't know if I would get here.
Right.
If not now, when? I don't know that I'm going to be around this afternoon. You might be the last person I spoke to.
God willing, you will be.
God willing. But the fact is that someone is not going to be around a half hour from now. That's around now. So either I do it now or maybe never.
So the whole quote, just to sum it up, if I'm not there for myself, nobody's going to be there for me. Don't stand in my own way. If I'm not there for other people, then what kind of a schmuck am I?
Yeah, that's right.
And then if I don't act on this now, then when?
That's right. Do it now, or you may never do it.
Don't procrastinate.
That's right.
All right. Well, good. I think we got it. I think we broke.
And the audience cannot see this, but I've done the whole thing on one foot.
It's true. You're sitting down.
But if you look under the table,
I can tell you, one foot, your legs are crossed, so one foot is dangling
in the air, and the other foot's on the ground. So I am not Hillel. I don't want to be arrogant about this. I'm not Hillel the Elder, but you can call me Mark the Middle-Aged.
Middle-Aged.
Instead of Hillel the Elder.
Well, Middle-Aged Mark, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, young fellow. Thanks for having
me. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That's our show. I want to thank Mark Schiff, my guest. I want to thank you guys. You guys, yes, you. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you, hopefully, for supporting the show, either by making a donation at moderndayphilosophers.net or by jumping on iTunes and leaving 5 stars and a nice comment. If you've done it already, you can do it again. It still helps. Helps a lot. By the way, don't be shy to share the show. Share the show with your friends. I like the way that rings. Share the show. Share the show. Don't be shy to share the show. If you can, post it up on Twitter or Facebook or wherever you may go. Share the show. Tell people about the show. And thank you guys. Reach out. Say hello. Share the show and say hello. Go to thecomical@yahoo.com. Shoot me an email. Say hello. I love hearing from you guys. It really is the highlight of doing this for me. So, that's it. I'll see you next week. Hopefully, God willing, and, oh, it's a good one. It's the season finale next week. This was, once again, the penultimate episode of season 4. So next week will be the season finale with a phenomenal guest and quite an interesting talk. I hope to see you there. All right, everybody. Have a great week. Talk to you soon. Bye.